Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Yud Daled Amud Aleph on the second line. Gemara asks, Ibai Elohu, Mahu Shisadru B'Bal Chov? What is the din with regards to arranging the matters of a Bal Chov? Now, given what we know from yesterday, the question is different depending on your view as to where the Braita yesterday was relevant. According to the Ramban, the Rashba, and those that follow that Shita, then the question is equally relevant to our Mishnah as it is to someone who is being govet, who is collecting. In that they saw no separation, no difference between taking a mashkon as well as to paying for the actual outstanding debt. And therefore there's a sidur that we arrange the matters for the individual, whether it is a case of taking a mashkon or whether it's a case of paying back gvia. On the other hand, the Baalei Tosafot believe that it's only relevant in the place of gvia, in the place of payment, not relevant in the place of mashkon. You can see that the Baalei Tosafot twice over here on this daf do that. Once at the end of Ma'arachin, Shein Machzirin Misadrin, over there he says, Aval kishenotel b'tarat mashkon, dechai ve'arachin memashkenin otan, azein misadrin, b'shayach hazara. So he says, first of all, there is no such thing as misadrin when you're taking a mashkon. Over there, there's a relevance, we'll see a word in the Gemara today, of chazara, returning the item when the person needs that item. But as far as Sidur is concerned, at the end of that Tosafot, he says that it has no relevance to a mashkon, as well as on the top of the Amud Bet, he makes a similar statement, which is that, aval hecha denatal b'torat gvia, yochol demochro miyad, velo yisadru klau. So over there also, he says that when they take it b'torat gvia, he can't sell it right away, and there is no sidur over there. So again, the Baalei Tosafot see this issue of sidur connected to gvia, to absolute collection, and not to the taking of mashkon. Therefore, the Gemara's question over here, Yibailahu Maushi Sadru B'Bal Chov, is not a question relating to our Mishnah, where you're taking a mashkon, but rather related to the question of repayment of the loan. If the Beit Din is going to go and enforce the debtor's obligation to the creditor, how do they assess his assets and what do they leave him behind? That's the question for the Baalei Tosafot. Again, for the Ramban and those that believe that the two are the same, then the question is equally relevant to our Mishnah. When you're taking a mashkon from our Mishnah, what do you have to leave behind in terms of his basic necessities? So Maushi Sadru B'Bal Chov. So again, do we arrange the matters for this debtor so that he's left with some minimum amount? Again, what that minimum amount is and how you determine what it is, whether that's influenced by the Braita yesterday, those minimum items that the Braita mentioned, or like the Ramban suggests that the Braita is just differentiating between items which you must not take because they are basic necessities that you would have to give back at all times, versus items that you take that are only used either during the day or during the night, so you do have the ability to return them. Mi gamar micha micha mi'arachin. Although, do we learn out this gezeira shava from arachin or not? So here again, we mentioned this yesterday with regards to misadrin, because the end of the braita had that line that compared bal chov to arachin. Again, arachin is found at the end of Parshat Bichukotai. It's a fixed schedule of payments for a person who says that I'm going to dedicate the value in this particular language of erech to the mikdash. Over there is a table that is set out by gender and age about how much you pay per person. At the end of that parshia, it says that if the ability of the person is somehow inhibited from paying what is stated in the schedules, then there is a dispensation for him to have it reduced to a lower price. And that is v'machu me'erkecha. If he is too poor to meet the schedule that is laid out over here, v'mido lifnei ha'kohen, then you bring him before the kohen, v'erich oto ha'kohen. And the kohen assesses the value that he can pay. Al pi asher tasig yad hanoder yarichenu ha'kohen. Whatever he can afford, the kohen assesses what he has to pay. And then that is a discharging of the obligation. That means that there's no longer any outstanding obligation. So he's paying cents on the dollar, whatever that decision is, that is his payment to the mikdash, and he's discharged his obligation. He has no obligation vis-a-vis the rest of the amount of money that he had, quote-unquote, pledged based on the tables that are here. That is a unique din that is found by arachin, not by any other hektesh, not by any other matter, that we assess the capability of the individual to pay. You have something like that with regards to a korban, oleh v'yored, where we assess the ability of the person to bring which of the standards in the korban. But here, it's really a true assessment of his assets and ability to pay that's here. So the question is, does that have application beyond Arachin? And one of those applications would be here by the case of someone who has fallen on hard times, is in poverty. Again, we've reiterated this, that the people borrowing here are borrowing for basic necessities. They're borrowing to eat. These aren't people just borrowing money to start up a business, right, or for capital improvements. These are people who are really in desperate needs. So the question is, do they have a similar dispensation as we have by Arachin? Because the term mimach, that is impoverished, is also used in Parshat Behar with regards to someone who falls on hard times, and that is v'chi yamuch achicha imach v'nim karlach. Person falls on hard times, and he's gotten to a point where he's destitute, and he's sold to you, lo tavod avodat aved. And then there are a series of parshiot that we actually dealt with in the past about what are the rules here of the person being sold, and how does he buy himself out, how many years is he enslaved. But it uses the term yamuch achicha. So there, the Gemara is talking about this gzereshava of micha, micha. That gzereshava, is it applicable here or not? Tashma. The shalech rabin bigarte. So rabin sent in a letter. Dova zesha alti l'chol rabutai. I asked this question to all of my rabbeim. Velo amruli davar. And they did not respond to me. I don't think it means they didn't respond to him. They had no mesorah, evidence as to which way the halacha was in this matter. Biram. But there was one similar question that was posed. Here where a person commits to give 100 zuz to the Bedek Habayit, do they do this sidur? Do they look at his capability to pay when he has to discharge the obligation of the neder that he took towards the Mikdash? So now, in that case, it's regular hekdesh. It's not a hekdesh that is associated with Arachin. This is a neder. There's a neder and hekdesh of the same din as Arachin. Rabbi Yaakov Mishmei de Bar Poda, Rabbi Yirmiya Mishmei de Ilfa Amrei, Kavuchomer mi Balchov. They say that it is a logical extension from Balchov. Ma Balchov shemachzirin, ein misadrin. By the case of Balchov, where they do return it, ein misadrin, they do not give him this asset test. Hekdesh ein machzirin, ein odin shein misadrin. Then by Hekdesh, where they don't do the return, then Ein Misadrin, it would make sense that they should also not deal with his capability to pay. So obviously this is a side way to get at the matter, which is that they're using Balchov as a paradigm. And the way that they're using Balchov as a paradigm is that Balchov does not have this din of Misadrin. Now here they separate between two issues. One issue is Machzirin. That when you take a mashkon with regards to a balchov, you have an obligation to return that mashkon. Meaning that if it's something that the individual needs, or according to the Ramban and those others that follow that shita, that when it's a kli ochel nefesh, during the time that he doesn't use it for ochel nefesh, that you're allowed to take that mashkon, there's an obligation to return those mashkonot at the time that he needs it, or the time that he's performing ochel nefesh, then he has to return the mashkon to the individual from whom he took it. So in that case, Baal Chov has a din of machzirin, but does not have a din of misadrin. Does not have a din of an asset test to see if he has the capability to pay, meaning that he's going to have to pay the whole thing. If he can't pay now, he's going to have to pay later. The debt will remain outstanding. There is no agreement or a payment of cents on the dollar to discharge his obligation with regards to a Baal Chov. So by Hekdesh, when Hekdesh takes a mashkon, you're not going to get that mashkon back. They have no obligation to return the mashkon to the individual. And so then it should be obvious that you're not going to make any asset test or arrangement in order to allow to pay cents on the dollar. If by lay people he doesn't have that right, certainly he's not going to have that right by Hekdesh. So therefore, based on what this other question was asking and their utilization of Balchov as the premise for the answer to the question, we now have an answer about Balchov, which is that Balchov doesn't have a din of Sidur, according to this. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Neder Be'erkecha Ktiv. The Pasuk by Arachin uses a term of Neder. And Neder usually involves a commitment to pay, irrespective of the tables or schedules in the Torah. So if one says that I want to give the value of an individual, not using the term Erech, but the value of this individual to the Mikdash, then he has to pay the true value of that individual to the Mikdash. the schedules that are mentioned in the Torah, in Parshat Bechukotai, are not relevant in that case. So now you have two terminologies that are being used. One is neder, that he made a promise or a commitment to the Mikdash, but it says Be'er Kecha, that he was doing Arachim. So Rabbi Yochanan sees in this a correlation or a hekesh between nedarim and Arachim. And therefore, Ma Arachim Misadrin, just like by Arachim, where we have an explicit pasuk that we make arrangements for him to pay when he cannot afford it, Av Egdesh Misadrin. So too, by Egdesh, we would make similar arrangements. So Rabbi Yochanan sees the answer to the question, having nothing to do with Balchov, but the answer to the question comes from Arachim, which is we're going to extrapolate the din of Arachim to the remainder of Hekdesh because of this Hekesh between Neder and Erkecha. The Idach, what does the other party do? Hau l'nidon b'chvodo hu da'ata. So the other party, what does he do with this Neder ve'erkecha? If he doesn't use it for the Hekdesh, for the Hekesh, what does he do with it? He says, that comes to teach you that he's nidon b'chvodo. This is a special din that applies by Arachin, and that is because by Arachin, the Torah uses the term nefashot. Daberel b'nei Yisrael, v'amarat aleihem, ish ki'afli neder, be'erkecha, so that's the kekesh between neder and erkecha that we saw, nefashot la'ashem. So from here they learn that the din of Arachin is connected to the nefesh, quote-unquote. Which means that if a person comes along and says, erech of a, not a whole individual, but a particular part of an individual to the Mikdash. Now technically, that's not relevant, because Arachin deal with the whole person, not with any particular organ that the person is speaking about. On the other hand, if he says an organ, the Mishnayot and Arachin tell us you have to look at that organ. If it is a vital organ, by which, if it was removed, the person would no longer survive, then it's called Nefashot, and it's as if he dedicated to pay the entirety of that individual. If it's an organ by which he could live without it, then it's nothing in terms of Arachin. The same din now is being extrapolated to Nidarim, which is that the word Nefashot only appears in the Parshia of Arachin. By Nidarim, how do we know the din is the same? Which is Ma Arachim Nidon Bichvodo. Just like by Arachin, that din of determining whether the organ is vital or not, the way that the Gemara terms it is, something that is nishama tluya ba, that's something that the nishama is connected to, then he would have to pay the whole amount of the individual or the schedule that is listed in the Torah. If not, by Arachin, then he would pay nothing. Af Ekdesh nidon bichvodo. By Ekdesh, then also there, nidon bichvodo, which you mean by regular nidarim. Now by regular nidarim, you do not have the dispensation whereby if it's a single limb, then you don't have to pay at all, because nidarim don't have any fixed amount or fixed view of what you're supposed to be makdish. By Arachin, it's clear you're being makdish, the particular individual, and therefore the gender and age and all those factor in. But that's the whole individual. By nidarim, you could be makdish anything. You could be makdish a hand, you could be makdish a leg, you could be makdish anything you want, and better come by it. Therefore, nidon bichvodo is just a determination of how much you owe. So if a person dedicates a part of the body that is not vital to the survival of the body, then he will have to pay for that organ. How do you make that decision? You look at him if he's sold in the shuk as an eved, when he's monetized and sold without an arm or sold with an arm, then you can figure out what the value of the arm is, or the differential between those two sales would give you that value. And again, in a place and time where there were slave auctions, it was easy to determine these matters because people were sold in the auction, and then you could determine how much somebody's worth with an arm or without an arm. On the other hand, if it is an organ which is vital, then it's the equivalent of bayarachin. It's as if you've dedicated the value of the entire individual, and then you have to pay the full value of the individual as they would be sold in the slave market. Tosafot disagrees slightly with the way that Rashi terms the assessment here, that you look in the slave market as to someone sold with an arm or without an arm, because he says that that would overvalue the arm, because there is also an aesthetic side to that, which is not only are you looking at the value of the arm, but also for the person who's buying them, the person without the arm has a certain diminishment in value because of the aesthetics, and therefore it's going to overvalue the arm. And therefore, Tosafot says that the valuation is done in the following manner, which is Dein shamin barachin umad nizakim el shamin oto kilo hayta yado muchtevet l'rabo rishon. It's as if his arm was still dedicated to his original owner. V'lo kamo shenatna l'gamrei, but not like it was taken away totally. Daz mitkanei ha'eved, because then the eved has that aesthetic diminishment. The shaveh harbei pachot. And that's a serious diminishment in the value. It's an arm that you do not have utility of, rather than the missing arm itself.
Alright,
so over here also, only because of the word nefashot, but he sees the assessment of the value being done in a manner, not where the actual aver is missing, but rather what happens if you don't have entitlement to the utility of that aver. That's the value that we're looking at over here. So now the Gemara goes on and asks,
why
don't we say that you should be misader by Balchov by learning a kalvachomer from Arachin? Now the way Rashi learns this question is that the Gemara is asking an independent question. We've left behind the previous question where we were trying to determine about a Balchov, and then we went to Hekdesh and Arachin, and over there we had a machloket as to which way the Hekdesh went, whether Hekdesh should be like Arachin or should Hekdesh not be like Arachin. And then that was the conclusion of that limud over there, based on the Hekdesh between the Darim and Arachin. What is the value of that Hekdesh? How does that Hekdesh work? The Balei Tosafot deal with here, how come you can have what's called a Hekdesh l'chetzi? How can you have a half Hekdesh, which is basically what the Mandamer that argues on Rabbi Yochanan is doing, because he's saying that Neder and Arachim, there is a Hekesh as far as the issue of Nefashot is concerned, but there is no Hekesh with regards to it being Misadrin. So that means you're using the Hekesh halfway. We have a principle that a Hekesh either is or is not. I mean that you can't have a Hekesh Lechetzi. So Tosfot is perplexed by this. He comes up with a Svara that he proposes, and he says that Tzirich Lomar, the svara de kavachomer mevatel akesha kevin shenuchal amid akesha le davar acher. This is the logic that he proposes, that a kavachomer, which is a logical argument, generally a hekesh is not subject to logic, because a hekesh overrides logic. Even if it's illogical, the hekesh says you make this connection between the two items. So hekesh trumps logic in general. But over here, what the Balei Tosafot say is, if we can come up with a manifestation for the hekesh, and then on the other instances of the Hekesh, it is undermined by a logical argument of a Kal V'chomer, we will undermine the Hekesh on those particular parts where logic dictates. So he gives that suggestion. He goes on to suggest that maybe even a Gezeirah Shavah could do the same thing, that a Kal V'chomer could undermine parts of a Gezeirah Shavah. That if you have a Gezeirah Shavah, again, which should trump logic, as long as it's Mufneh, then there too, you could say that Gezeirah Shavah is not entirely used, because you have a logical argument that limits the scope of the Gezeirah Shavah. So Tosafot proposes this idea, but in the end, he says, I don't know if it'll stand the test. You have to listen to what he says here. But Tzarech Iyun says, you have to look into this matter. There are many times in Midrash Halacha of Vayikra, and in the Gemara, Shirotzeh Lasod Kal V'chomer, that many times the Gemara has a Kal V'chomer and undermines it by Hekesh. O Gezeirah Shavah. Im yesh b'chol makom, sheno ochal yamid Hekesh, o Gezeirah Shavah ledavar acher. In all those instances, is it really true that there's no other way to use the Gezeirah Shavah, there's no other way to use the Hekesh? Because his principle is, as long as there's no other manner to use it with, then the Kal V'chomer can't trump the Hekesh, and the Gezeirah Shavah can't trump the Hekesh. As long as you have two alternatives and you use one and don't use the other, then the Kal V'chomer can trump part of the Hekesh, or the Gezeirah Shavah can trump part of the Hekesh. He says in all these cases where the Gemara says, or the Midrash Halacha says that the Hekesh overrides logic, that means in those cases there was no other alternative. He says, is that really true? I don't know. You have to go through all of Shas and all of the Midrash Halacha to determine that. It's an interesting proposition here, that logic could override something that normally overrides logic. The Gemara explicitly says in a number of places that Hekesh overrides logic. That is why it's used, because then there's no longer a need to have it work logically. It's known to trump logic. The Tosafot starts to limit the scope of when that is true. So he says it really has to be tested, and it's a very large test because there's so many instances where it happens. And he's not sure that his thesis will actually work in every one of these cases. Now, in continuing the question, the Gemara says about a Balchov, that maybe we should say Misadrin. So Rashi sees this as going back to be an independent question. We're leaving behind what we said before. It's not a question on the previous parties, but rather a question of the Gemara in general. But then the Gemara goes back and forth between two parties. It's not clear who the two parties are then. If we're talking about the machloket that was until now, then we understand what the two parties are. Rashi claims that the two parties are the parties of our Mishnah, which is in our Mishnah, where you have the Tana Kama and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. That's where the Gemara is bouncing back and forth about their positions in this question. That only works if you believe Ms. Sadrin is relevant to our Mishnah, where you have a Mashkon. For the Balia Tosfot to separate between Ms. Sadrin and for Gviah, then our Mishnah is not relevant by Ms. Sadrin. Ms. Sadrin is only relevant by the case of Gviah. So then you have to say that this is a continuation of the previous part of the Gemara, not some new statement connected to our Mishnah. The Gemara asks here, you said, Juba Bachov, Kavachomer, mi Arachin. So logically, why don't you say a Bachov has to do Sidor because of Arachin? Ma Arachin, Shein Machzirin, Misadrin. By Arachin, where you do not return the Mashkon if you take a Mashkon to compel payment, Misadrin. Yeah, we do give dispensations or Hakalot on the individual to pay less than it is owed because he doesn't have the capability to pay. Bachov, Shein Machzirin. By Bachov, we already demand that the person gives back the Mashkon. We certainly should make some arrangements for him with regards to his payment. If we already allow for this right of return of the Mashkon, then we're showing that we're being more lenient on the debtor. If we're already more lenient on the debtor, we should also be more lenient on the debtor when it comes to Misadrin. Again, the connection between the two items, according to the Ramban, is absolute, because for him, Mashkon also has Misadrin. Whereas for the Baal Tosafot, these are separate issues, but they both show the same thing, which is leniency towards the debtor. So Amakra, the Pasuk says, V'imachu me'erkecha. If he is unable to pay, his assets don't give him the capability to pay. The word who is always a miyut. Hu v'lo bachov. Hu v'lo bachov means him and not a bachov. Now v'idach, who is the other party? According to Rashi over here, idach is the Tanakama of our Mishnah. Until now, we were speaking about Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, which is when you come to sell at the end of the 30 days, then are you misadrin? So Rashi puts it into the sheet of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who says that after you take the mashkon, you monetize the mashkon at the end of that period. So we're talking about collection of the loan now. And that's how Rashi makes it work in our Mishnah, even though we're talking about misadrin, because it's talking about Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's opinion. So now the Gemara goes, v'idach. Hi, who? What does he do with the word who? So what does the Tana Kama do with the word who? Hi, Achei Machuto Mitchilato V'Ad Sofo. He has to be impoverished from beginning to end. So the way that Baliat Tosafot explains it in the, it happens to be a Machloket Tanaim in the Gemara in Arachin, is what does that mean? Do you have to be impoverished from beginning to end? Or is at the point of assessment? Or the other possibility is at the point of the Neder? Where do you have to be poor in order to have to pay? So here it says you have to be impoverished from beginning to end. That means that in a situation in which the person was impoverished at the time of the neder, he became enriched in between, and then became impoverished again at the time that he's being assessed. So at both points, the point of the neder and the point of payment, he was poor, and he should get a dispensation. But because he became wealthier in the interim, that makes it that he doesn't have this right because of this. Who tells he has to be a mach? He has to be impoverished from beginning to end. So now the Gemara says, V'yachziru be'akdesh, kal v'chomrim b'balchov. So now the Gemara is moving around in logical arguments and saying, okay, by a balchov, where there is no sidur, we still return the mashkon. By akdesh, then we should definitely return the machzon. Why? Ma balchov she'ein misadrin. By balchov, where we give no asset dispensation for repayment of the loan. Machzirin, yet we still demand that the mashkon be given back. Hekdesh shemisadrin, according to Rabbi Yochanan, where you have a hekesh between neder and erkecha, where we do our misader by hekdesh, we do make an asset dispensation to pay cents on the dollar. Enu din shemachzirin, certainly there should be a dispensation for taking back the mashkon when necessary. Amar kra, v'shachav b'salmato uveirachecha. So that's the pasuk that we find in Barim. It says, Hashem tashiv lo et avot kivu ha-shemesh, v'shachav b'samato, uveiracheka, ulechati et tzedakah lifnei Hashem lokecha. So you will receive a bracha for the fact that you are returning his pajamas so that he can wear his pajamas at night. So you're given a bracha. So the Gemara says,
Yotze Hekdesh ain't tzarich bracha. Hekdesh doesn't require a bracha. In essence, God doesn't need the bracha because God is the source of all brachot. So here where the Torah promises a bracha for returning the item, that's to engender or to effectuate a bracha that you will receive. So someone who is in need of brachot, that din makes sense for. Someone who's not in need of brachot, that din will not be applicable to. And therefore the din of machzirin is limited to lay people. It's not relevant by Hekdesh. Gemara says, v'lo, Hashem doesn't need brachot, Hekdesh doesn't need brachot, v'aktiv, v'achalta, v'savata, uverachta. So wait a minute, the pasuk says with regards to eating, consuming the produce of the land, that one has to make a bracha afterwards, giving a bracha to Hashem, both to the land and to Hashem, thanking Hashem for that which he received. So we see bracha is relevant by Hashem. We also have the Gemara in brachot, where Rabbi Yishmael enters into the Kodesh HaKodeshim, and over there, HaKodesh Baruch Hu says to him, Barchuni b'nei, give me a blessing, my son. So we see there is a relevance of bracha to HaKodesh Baruch Hu, and that relevance should make it that the din here is also relevant. Now the truth is, by bracha, it's very interesting, because in bracha towards Hashem is different than the way we look at bracha towards a layperson. Right? The bracha towards Hashem in general is our acknowledgement of what Hashem does, or the power that Hashem has. The bracha towards us is for success, and for the ability for things to go our way, and to be favorable towards us. So it's interesting, but the nature of the bracha is different, even though the terminology bracha is used in both cases, that the word blessing is used. In one case, it's the blessing should devolve upon us. In the other case, the blessing is a blessing of thanksgiving towards a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And even that by Rabbi Shmuel, where he's giving the bracha to Hashem, it's really a bracha that's reflexive, which is that your midat harachamim should overcome your midat hadin. Well, that's for our benefit, that his midat harachamim should overcome his midat hadin. So even that bracha is a bracha that really is a blessing towards us, and not a bracha in the real sense that we would think towards a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Despite that, the Gemara sees them as being equated in this din, and therefore the din would be applicable. El amar kra, udachatzli et staka. That will be a staka for you. Mi shetzarich staka. For those that require staka. Yatzek desh, she'en zarich staka. So that's true of people who have ups and downs and who require staka and give staka. That's not true to Kodesh Baruch Hu, where he has no needs, meaning that he can fulfill or take care of all of his needs. There is no needs of tzedaka. Again, we're looking at this in the broader sense of Hekdesh. Sometimes Hekdesh does need to raise money. They need a capital campaign. They have to raise money. But that's not what we're thinking about. We're thinking about Hekdesh in the broader sense that it's God's dominion. And in that sense, God's not needy in any way. Ashkecha, Rabba Baravua, Be'eliyahu. Dekoyi bebeit hakvarot shel ovdei kochavim. So here we enter into an interesting world. Rabbi Baravua bumps into Eliyahu, and he poses him questions. Now he bumps into Eliyahu, not as Eliyahu a Navi, but rather as Eliyahu, one of the Chachamim. Similar to what we find in the Tana de Bei Eliyahu, that there's a whole series of brightot that are attributed to the Beit Midrash of Eliyahu. He found him, and he was sitting or present in the non-Jewish cemetery. Amarle, here he goes on to ask a number of questions of him. Mashush Sadru Bibalchov. Our question here, what is the din with regards to doing Misader at Balchov? Do we have this dispensation to reduce the payment based on the capability of the person to pay? Amarle, Gamar Micha, Micha Marachin. That Gzeirah Shavah that we opened the Gemara with, he says we do have that Gzeirah Shavah. Those are the psukim that we read at the beginning of today's daf. And therefore he says that the Gzeirah Shavah is in force. That's why I opened this scenario. This is not Eliyahu and Navi. This is Eliyahu, the Talmud Chacham. And that avoids the problem of Lo B'Shamayim Hi. But that also means that the halacha will not necessarily be like Eliyahu. And that's what the Rabbeinu Tam says over here. With all due kavod to Eliyahu, the halacha is not like Eliyahu. The Rabbeinu Tam says over here, Pasak Rabbeinu Tam b'sefer yashar, de'im b'sadrim b'balchov. Only the Rabbeinu Tam could do that. He paskins against Eliyahu and says there's no sidur b'balchov. There's no such thing. Part of his evidence is from the fact that we have a principle that the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel b'mishnateinu. The halacha is always like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel in the Mishnah, unless we have an explicit statement to the contrary by an amora. And here we have no Amoraim discarding that position of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. That means that the position of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel in our Mishnah dictates. In our Mishnah, when it dictates, we said before that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel cannot be reconciled with the issue of Misadrin. Because Rabbi Shimon Gamliel believes that Kol B'nai Yisrael are B'nai Melachim Heim. And therefore, there is no way that Misadrin is relevant to the Shita of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. That's what we saw at the end of yesterday's daf. That means if we paskin like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, we're also paskin that ain't Misadrin. Based on that, the Rabbeinu Tam says, Halacha is not like Eliyahu HaNavi. In order not to be head-on with Eliyahu HaNavi, he amends the girsa over here, and he finds evidence of it in other works, which is the question that Rabbi Baravua asked over here is, Mahu. That's how it headed. Mahu is a halachic question. Is it or is it not? On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Tam said the question was Minayin, not Mahu. From where would you know? Meaning, according to those people that believe Misadrin, what is the source for Misadrin? In that case, it's not a halachic question, it's a source question. And that's how the Rabbeinu Tam gets out of being head-on with Eliyahu HaNavi. Although, in the next items, we'll see that he also doesn't necessarily agree with Eliyahu HaNavi. And once again, paskins against Eliyahu HaNavi. Minayin darum shelo yitrum. How do we know that someone who is naked may not take off trumot masrot? Dichtiv, because it says, lo yireh becha ervat davar, that you should not be able to see erva bidavar when you are saying something. The truth is that the question is actually phrased improperly. The evidence to the Rabbeinu Tam is the question here is minayin, which would be similar to what the Rabbeinu Tam claims the previous question was also minayin. But the question is not whether you could take off trumot masrot. The taking off of trumot masrot can be done and has nothing to do with being naked or not naked. The problem is making the brocha when you take off trumot masrot. The Chachamim instituted birkat mitzvah. The problem is you're not allowed to take a birkat mitzvah when libo ro'eh ervato. When his heart sees his erva, you're not allowed to take off for trumot masrot to make the brocha. And that's the question here, and that's what Rashi says. B'shash atam midaber, that's the word davar comes. Lo yira ebecha ervat davar. Shmamina, ein adam yivarech shu arum b'toreim ba'i brocha. One cannot make a brocha. One cannot daven. One cannot be b'tfilah when he sees an erva. It's a whole sugya in the Gemara in brochot. And the key element is that the lave, the heart, may not see the erva. It's not about visuals or your eyes. It's the separation between the heart and the erva. And that's the source for wearing a garto. The garto is what separates when you wear a tunic between the heart and the erva. The belt sits between those two areas. And that's what creates the separation between them. Again, today we don't have that issue necessarily because you have elastic underwear or boxers or you have a belt that you're wearing around your pants. And therefore they automatically separate between the lave and the erva. Meaning that there are ways to separate without using a garto. So there might be a separate issue which the Gemara in Shabbat writes about, which is hachon likrat elokecha, that one has to prepare to go before their creator when they daven. And therefore you have to do some sort of preparation. So the garto might be that sense, that's what the Gemara calls it over there, is a preparation for entering before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's doing something. So one could do that in another way. It doesn't have to be a garto. It can be in other ways or fashions, whether it is putting on a jacket, washing one's hands, which is probably a good idea because the Rambam thinks it's ma'akev tefillah. So there are other ways to do it in preparation for tefillah, to do something that prepares you to stand before God. And Amrlei, and this is the final question, which is the real one that seems to be bothering him, is Lav Kohen Humar. Aren't you a Kohen? Rashi says over here, how does he know Eliyahu Navi is a Kohen? Because there is nowhere in Tanakh that it ever mentions that Eliyahu Navi is a Kohen. At most, it says that he's meet Eliyahu Giladi, which is that he came or he lived in Gilad. And we know that's where he starts his trek from and returns there over to Eber Yarden when he leaves and goes up to the Shemayim. But other than that, we have no evidence as to where Eliyahu was from. Especially if he was born in the Gilad, it would be even less likely that he was a Kohen, even though there were cities of Kohanim there. But we have no evidence of that fact. It's based on the Midrashim, as Rashi notes over here, Dika Lamandamer de Eliyahu Pinchas, that the Gemara correlates between, or the Midrashim correlate between Pinchas and Eliyahu. If Eliyahu is a reincarnation or a Pinchas, then he is a Kohen, because we know Pinchas is definitely a Kohen. Based on that, that is the question that is offered over here. The Balei HaTosafot go through a number of Midrashim that indicate that Eliyahu Navi was not a Kohen, that he was either from Shevet Binyamin, or he was from Shevet Gad, which obviously would argue on this premise. So the question is premised on a single dayah that believes Eliyahu Navi was a Kohen. Again, there's numerous midrashim that seem to indicate otherwise, that he was not a Kohen, and therefore the relevance of the question would diminish. And we'll see in a second why that is, because we would have serious problems in other issues, which is here, the Gemara asks the question, Amalei lav Kohen umar, my time a kaimar bebetak varot. If you're a Kohen, what are you doing inside of the cemetery? Amalei lo matne mar tarot. Didn't you learn Masechet Taarot or Seder Taarot? The Tanya, we have a Braita, B'shem Bayuchai Omer, Kivrehem Shel Ovdei Kochavim, Ein Mitamim. That the graves of non-Jews are not Mitameh. Now that is not necessarily completely true. The statement of B'shem Bayuchai is not that they are not Mitameh B'maga U'masa, is that they're not Mitameh B'ohel. That the Tumata Ohel only has application by Jews, does not have application by non-Jews, based on the pasuk in Yechezkel that says Shenemar, Vaten Soni, Son Mariti, Adam Atem, that you are called Adam, Atem Kuim Adam, Vein Ovdei Kochavim Kuim Adam. You have the terminology Adam used by you, but that is not true by the Ovdei Kochavim. And that is relevant because the Parshiyav Tumata Ohel in Pashat Chukat opens up with the term Adam. And therefore, the relevance of the Parshiyat would be only or limited to Jews and not have application by non-Jews. The pasuk says, Zota Torah, Adam ki amut bo'el, ko ba'al o'el, b'chol shebo, itma shivat yamim. So the term Adam is specifically used there by Tumata O'el. And therefore, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai believes that the Tumata O'el is limited to Jewish kvarim or Jewish corpses, and not to non-Jewish corpses. Therefore, Eliyahu Navi could trek through the non-Jewish cemetery because there's no din of Tumata Ohel. That is a lore or a legend about Shar HaRachamim in Yerushalayim, right outside of the Shar HaRachamim, which is the sealed-up Shar on the eastern side of the Har HaBayit that you could see from Har HaZeitim, which is the path or direction from which Eliyahu Navi would come to declare the Geula and Mashiach would come. And over there is a non-Jewish cemetery right outside Shar HaRachamim. And the lore, the legend has it, is that they placed the cemetery there in order that it would force the person coming to become Tamei, and therefore there could never be news, revelation of the Mashiach through there because of the non-Jewish cemetery. Undermining that would be this position of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, which says that there is no Tumata Ohel, and therefore the people can walk there without having any problem because it's all non-Jewish cemeteries, or graves, and not Jewish graves. That's just a sidebar to this conversation. The other problem is that the word Adam is used all over the Torah, and we don't always say that Adam means a Jew and not a non-Jew. So therefore, the Rishonim, not here, but in other places, come up with a differential or a way to distinguish when is it called Israel and when is it not called Israel. For instance, by Korbanot, we use the term Adam to say non-Jews can bring Nidarim and Nidavot. That says that Adam includes more than just Klal Yisrael. So the way the Rabbeinu Tam distinguishes is between the word Adam versus Ha-Adam. Whenever the term Adam is used, that references specifically to Jews and not to non-Jews, says Ha-Adam, then it refers to all of mankind in the generic sense, not just to Jews. The way that the Baalei Tosafot offer an alternative, or the Ramban and others offer an alternative, is depends on the context. The context is very important. And that is when Adam is used instead of Israel. Had you had the ability to use Israel and instead you used Adam, then in that case, Adam is coming to be inclusive and say that it includes non-Jews. In a case where Israel is not a relevant term, then the word Adam is exclusively Israel and not non-Jews. And so that's his claim over here, that the word Adam over here had to be used because of the context of the Psukim. That's clearly talking about Klal Yisrael, and therefore the Adam here is limited to Klal Yisrael. Based on that, there is no Tumat Ha'ol. So Amalei, Ba'arba'a lo Matzina, he says, I barely holding in four, B'shita Matzina, you want me to be holding in six? So there are different ways to interpret this. Four could either be the fourth Seder. The fourth Seder is Nizikim. That's what we're in now, Baba Metzia. And the question he asked about Chov is a question about Nizikin. He says, I don't even know the halachot about Nizikin. You're asking me about the sixth Seder? The sixth Seder is Ta'arot. So you expect me to know Ta'arot? So that's one way to read it. Rabbi Baravua is saying this back to Eliyahu. Eliyahu says, don't you know the Braita in Ta'arot from Moshe Bar Yochai? He's saying back to him, you expect me to know it. I don't even know Nizikin. You want me to know Ta'arot? That's one way to explain it. Rashi explains it over here. I know the four Mestarim that are still relevant today. And those are Moed, Nashim, Nizikin, and Kodoshim. Rashi says Kodoshim because Kodoshim, we have the din. It's brought to Gemara at the end of Menachot. Tells us that when you learn the dinim of Kodoshim, it's as if you're being makriv korbanot. So learning Kodoshim has relevance because that's why we say korbanot in the morning, because it's neshama parin sfateinu. It's as if we're bringing the korbanot. So Rashi says those are the four starim that are relevant, and the four starim that we have Gemara Bavli on. Whereas Zraim and Ta'arot are only relevant when, first of all, you live in Eretz Yisrael, and when there's Tuma and Tahara. So those aren't relevant today. They don't have a Bavli associated with them. So he doesn't know those two. The starim that are relevant today that he knows, the other two, he's not relevant today. He did not know. He was not familiar with. Or others say the four starim that he knew were Zraim, Moed, Nizikin, and Nashim. And whereas Kodashim and Ta'arot are the two that are not relevant except in the Binyan HaBayit, and those are the two that he doesn't know. Now it's obvious that he knew the Mishnayot. That's not the question now. He knew the Mishnayot of Shisha Sidrei Mishnah. All the Tanaim, the Amoraim know the Shisha Sidrei Mishnah. That wasn't the question. Here it's a Braita that is brought. So with regards to Braitot, in the four main Starim, he knew the Braitot. But with regards to a Braita in Ta'arot, that he was not familiar with because it wasn't a common Seder that was learned. He knew the Mishnayot, but he didn't know the Braitot. So that is a response to Eliyahu. So then, question the Baal Yitos would raise is, what about the son of the impoverished Almanah who passed away, who Eliyahu revives? How is he able to revive the child if the child's already passed away? That means there's Tumat Amet. Over there, we're talking about a Jewish child. How does Eliyahu do a resurrection of a dead person if he can't become Tamei Tumat Amet? So Tosfot is perplexed by his answer here that has to do with De Kochavim, where we find Eliyahu was dealing with other issues, dealing with Meitim, despite the fact that he is a Kohen. So very good. So Tosfot brings that possibility. Tosfot brings the possibility that the answer to that question is that it was Pikuach Nefesh, not real Pikuach Nefesh. Pikuach Nefesh involves a person who's alive. So you can't claim Pikuach Nefesh. Eliyahu knew that he could succeed at reviving him. Since he could succeed at reviving him, then it became Pikuach Nefesh for Eliyahu, because he knew he could revive him. And that's what gave him permission to become Tamei. That's one possible answer. The other possible answer is that he's a Navi, and it comes out Pete Tzivoy Hashem. It's not exactly a Tzivoy Hashem, because Eliyahu and Elisha act on their own in many instances without a Tzivoy Hashem. We assume that they're acting capacities as Nevi'im, but they don't get a direct command from Hashem to do these things, and they still do them. So you have to say that there's an implied Tzivoy Hashem to resurrect this individual. Or you can argue, like some of the Rishonim do argue, is that the child never really passed away. They argue that by Eliyahu and by Elisha, that the child had simulated the symptoms of death, but they really were in some sort of coma, or they needed mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And that's basically what he does. He performs hachaya on the individual. He performs mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on the individual. And that's what's described there. And there are Rishonim that subscribe to that. It's not a newfangled perush. But in that case, the child was never really absolutely dead, meaning that there was no tumat amet involved here. Right? No pulse or symptoms that simulate the death, but the child was not actually dead. In that case, it wouldn't be an issue of tumat amet. So here, see Tosafot and other Rishonim trying to deal with the problems that arise if you think Eliyahu was a Kohen. But again, in the end, the Baal Yad Tosafot bring that there are many Midrashim that indicate otherwise. And number two is, again over here, the Rabbeinu Tam uses this as a proof that we don't always paskin like Eliyahu, because he says that over here, when we quote this din of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, the Rabbeinu Tam at least believes that's not the halacha. And the halacha is that there is Tumat Oel by Goyim. And again here, he's going against this position of Eliyahu Navi, because he's not acting as a Navi. If he was acting as a Navi, it would be Lo Shabayim here, so he'd have no relevance at all. Since he's acting as a Chacham, Then you have a machloket tanaim, and machloket tanaim you can paskin against Eliyahu and Navi in those cases.
All right, so then amalei v'amai.
Eliyahu says back to Rabbi Baravua, why aren't you learning tarot, or why aren't you learning the bright by tarot? Says amalei dechikali milta.
He says I'm impoverished, making ends meet is very difficult, and I just don't have the wherewithal to learn and sit, either because I have to work to make ends meet, or I don't have the yeshiva dat, or the head, to do this because I'm impoverished. I have to scrounge around for food and for whatever my basic needs are.
Dabre v'ayale the Gan Eden. He took him, brought him up to Gan Eden. Amalei pashot glimech, safi shokol mehani tarfe. Says, take off your cloak and use that as like a sack of sorts, and collect from these leaves that are found here in Gan Eden.
Safa, shakal.
He went ahead and did what Eliyahu Navi instructed. Take these leaves and go out. They were aromatic, fragrant leaves that if he took them back, he would be able to sell and monetize for large sums of money. And for that reason, that would take care of his dechika milta. Kavinofik, on his way out, Shama hears the voice, the kamar, manka achil la'alme karabar baravua. Who's eating up his world like Rabbi Baravua? Who's basically taking his reward from Olam Haba in Olam Hazeh? He's chewing up what would be left for him when he gets to Olam Haba. Nofatz shadinu. He shook out the cloak and left all the leaves behind. He was unwilling to take that which was in Olam Haba and eat from that which was in Olam Haba. Afilu hochi. Despite that, atya l'glime, the cloak absorbed the fragrance from these leaves. Sachad glima reichas. He was able to squeeze out that smell or fragrance from the cloak. Zavne betresar alfe dinare. He sold it for 12,000 dinarim, which was an exorbitant sum of money. So in the end, he did gain that money. Palginu elechantan vate. And he distributed it amongst his son-in-laws. So it sounds like he either only had daughters, or chatanim means his children who were of age to get married, but he distributed amongst his children this money so that they had the means or wherewithal to live by. Anyway, obviously this is all allegorical, but the point I think Eliyahu was making is he was worried about his situation or circumstances Olam Hazeh. Eliyahu gives him a glimpse at Olam Haba. But the idea being that there are certain situations which we say Torah is one of those things that a person is ochel miperutem olam hazeh vekeren kayemet olam haba. So over here, when he went to take the keren from olam haba, they rejected that. Taking the leaves, taking that which was in olam haba, they rejected. But he did get the peirot. He did get the smell or the reyach. He got the peirot, and that he was able to benefit from in this world. And that's what it means that he got the peirot of olam hazeh without impinging on his keren kayemet olam haba. And that's why he left the leaves behind, but still got the benefit of getting attached to it, or the touching of Olam Haba still affected him in Olam Hazeh. Return Rabbanan, Ve'im ish anihu lo tishkav ba'avuto. The Pasuk says that if he's an impoverished individual, you should not sleep with his mashkon, meaning that you should return it. Ha ashir shachiv. That means that if he's wealthy, he should be shachiv. Now, the way that the Gemara is reading this, according to Rashi, is that an ani, you're not allowed to sleep with his pajamas or with his comforters. But an ashir, you can sleep in his pajamas or you can use his comforters. That means, according to Rashi, you're effectively charging him interest. Because when you take the mashkon, you're utilizing the mashkon, and that means you're getting benefit from the mashkon because you lent him money. That's effective interest. Why are you allowed to use or utilize the items of the rich individual unless you do it in a manner that defeases the loan? If not, then it's effective interest. So Gemara says, "My kamar." So what's being said over here? I'm of sheshed ochi kamar. This is what it means. Im ish anihu lo tishkav vavato etzlecha. If the debtor is impoverished, then you should not go to sleep while his mashkon is with you. Ha ashir shachiv vavato etzlecha. But when it comes to a wealthy individual, you can't go to sleep while the mashkon is here because he has other items to use. He has capability to live without the mashkon that you took from him. Tarabanan, amavet chaviro, eno rashay la mashkono, ve'eno chayav lachzir lo, vover b'chol ha'shemot olalu. So you have three statements in the Braita, which are hard to reconcile. The first one of which is,
someone who lends to his friend may not take a mashkon. The second one is, if you have a mashkon, eino chayav lachzir lo. You don't have to give it back. Well, if he can't take a mashkon, how does he have a mashkon that he doesn't have to give back? So how does the second statement correlate to the first statement? Vover b'chol ha'shem el talalu. And then he's in violation of all of these lavin that are, we read before, that are associated with the mashkon. He's in violation of them. How is he in violation of them if he didn't take a mashkon and he doesn't obligate it to give them back? So then why is he in violation of the lavin? My kamar. What is meant by this braita that has these three statements? Amar Rav Sheshet Achi Kamar. This is how you read the braita. Hamavet chaveiro enu rashay l'mashkono. A person who lends to his friend is not permitted to take a mashkon from that individual. That's already, we determined in our Mishnah that he doesn't have a right to take a mashkon because you're not allowed to enter his house, you're not allowed to take a mashkon. And we saw in the Mishnah that that meant not only to take a mashkon, but that even meant in the tuach in tuche. I mean, even to take the mashkon outside of his house, there was a dayad that believed that you weren't allowed to take a mashkon at all. V'imashkono, chayav lachzir lo. If he does take a mashkon, then he must return it to him. Vover b'chol ha'shemot alalu aseifa. And the fact that you're in violation goes on the seifa, which means if you do take the mashkon, which you are not permitted to take, then you violate all the lavin that are mentioned in the Torah. And if you do violate all of those lavin, then you have to give it back, like zirlo. You have to give it back to him, which make it that these are alav ani takli asei in some ways. That's a separate discussion about this, because then you may not be in violation of all of these lavin, or you may not get malkot. That's a separate discussion about whether there is malkot for kuvesh sachar sechir, as well as taking a mashkon, because of the ability to rectify the situation. Rava Amar Achi Kamar, this is the way to read the braita. Amavet chevero eno rashay demashkeno. If a person lends money to his friend, he may not take a mashkon. If he mashkeno, chayav lachzir lo. If he does take a mashkon, he's obligated to return the mashkon. Bamed dvarim amurim. When is that true? Shemashkeno shelo b'shat halvato. That's only when he takes it, not at the time of the extension of the loan. This is what we said before, that a person has a right to take a mashkon at the time of the loan, because that is the vehicle for him extending the loan. And he can make any demands when he wants to extend the loan as to how he wants to extend the loan. He can set the terms of the loan. So the origination of the loan can be done on your terms. But when it's not b'shat avato, after the loan, now you want to come and take collateral, that you do not have a right to do. Aval mashkeno b'shat avato, if he does take it out at that time, eino chayav lechazir lo, then you don't have to give it back. So that's what it means, eino chayav lechazir lo. You don't have to return it, because there you rightfully took the mashkon. You rightfully took the mashkon, and therefore, you do not have to return it. Vover b'chol ha'shemet olalu aresha. And the vover b'chol ha'shemet olalu is going to resha. Meaning that, according to Rav Sheshet, when you take the mashkon, that's when you're in violation of the lavin. Because for him, taking the mashkon is the illegal act. For Rava, the illegal act was not necessarily taking the mashkon, because in the latter half of the braita, taking the mashkon was permitted because you did it at the time of the origination. But if you did it like you did in the resha, which is you took the mashkon not at the time of the loan, that's when you're in violation of the lav, and that's when all these shemot apply. Rashi notes the reason that by origination of loans, there's no restriction against taking a mashkon, and there's no obligation to return it, is because it says the cry, it says the Pesukim are specifically speaking about after the loan is extended. Because if the mashkon comes to him in a voluntary manner, that's not called chabalah. And that's what I noted on the Mishnah as well, that Rashi's view, as well as that of the Bali Tosafot, is that chabalah is only applicable when you go into the house of the individual and take it. If the item comes to you, that's not called chabalah. And that's why Rashi says that all the psukim there have no relevance to a mashkon taken at the time of the origination of the loan, because that was given willingly. And since it was given willingly, it's not called chabalah. Tani Rav Shizvi, kamei de Rava. So Rav Shizvi was presenting these braitot before Rava. So here he presents braitot and reads them and goes over them, reviews them in front of Rava. So then Rava gives comments on the braitot as he's presenting them. It says, Ad bo ha-shemesh. The pasuk says in Mishpatim, Im chavol tachvol samat reyacha, ad bo ha-shemesh tishivenu lo. Until the sun rises, you have to give it back to him. The Braita says, Zok sut laila. That is his night items, his pajamas. Hashev tashiv lo et avot kivah shemesh. The pasuk in Kitetze says, Hashev tashiv lo et avot kivah shemesh. V'shachav b'salmato u'berchacha l'chad yetziyacha l'fnei Hashem l'kecha. That by sunset, you have to return him the item. Zok sut yom. That is his day wear. Amar lei, Rava responds to him. Di yomama b'leoya lomali, u'delelya b'yomama lomali. Seems to be totally counterintuitive and backwards. It says here, by sunrise, make sure to give him his pajamas. What's he going to do with his pajamas during the day? And it says, by sunset, make sure to give him his day clothing. What do you need a day clothing at night for? It seems completely opposite. Amar lei ismei. She says, should I erase it from the database? The database is this guy's head, where he remembers all the bright dot, he's presenting the bright dot. Should I erase this from my list of bright dot? Amar lei lo. Don't erase it. Hachi kamar. This is the way to understand it, which is, ad bo shemesh tishivenu lo. Until the sun rises, return it to him. Zog sut yom shinitna lachbo balayla. That is the day wear that you're allowed to take at night. So the ksud layla that we're speaking about is not the night wear, but it is the begadim that you're allowed to take at night. What is that? That's the daytime begadim, which you're allowed to take as a mashkon at night and return in the morning. So that means at sunrise, give him back his day wear so he can wear it during the day. Hashev tashiv lo et avot kivo shemesh. At sunset, zog ksut layla. This refers to the ksut layla, shinitna lachbo bayom. It's called ksut yom because you're allowed to take it or to, as a mashkon during the day. So you have to return his pajamas by nightfall, by the time of sunset. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Yochanan says, mashkino, if he took the mashkon and then returned it to him because he asked for it back, he needed it back, umeit, and he passes away, shomto mi'al bebe benav. He can go snatch it away from the children. Doesn't literally mean he has to snatch it off of them, although it could be true. It means that generally a creditor has only rights to karka, does not have rights to metaltalin. Over here, he does have rights to these metaltalin because the mashkon became his. When he returned it to the debtor, he's lending it to the debtor, he's not giving it to the debtor. And therefore he has a right to take this in payment or in lieu of payment of his loan, and he can keep the mashkon. That's what our Mishnah says. Immate, and when he passes away, he's no longer has to be makzirit. He no longer has to give it back to the Yorshim. The same is true as even if the Yorshim are in possession of it, he can go and take it back because it's his. Meitave, is that really true? I'm Rabbi Meir. If you're taking a machshon, why are you giving it back? This is your question. Lama machzirin? Why are we giving it back? Rachmanu amar, hadar. The Torah says, return it. What do you mean? That's why you give it back. Torah says, give it back. Ella, me'achar shemachzirin. If you have to give it back anyway, lama chozrim mashkinin. Why do we take it as a mashkon? Meaning that, if you always have to return it, then what's the point of taking the mashkon? In the first place, the question was, if you're taking a mashkon, why are you giving it back? The answer to that question is, that's a gzeirat hakatuf. The Torah says, give it back, you give it back. The problem then is, if you're giving it back, what's the point of taking a mashkon? A mashkon's worthless if you have to always give it back because you don't have it. The whole point of a mashkon is that you hold it. So the Gemara gives, lama chozrim mashkinim, why do you go back and take a mashkon? Shelo tehei shvi'it misham tato. So that shvi'it will not wipe out the loan. This is what we spoke about again at the 2 days ago daf. We spoke about what's the point of taking a mashkon, you have to return it. One reason is Shemitah. If you have a mashkon for a loan, it's no longer governed by the Shemitah Ksafim, because Shemitah Ksafim is the only way you have to go and collect. Over here you don't have to collect, because if collected already with the mashkon. So that's one reason. Number two is, v'lo yaseh metaltalin meitzel banav. Number two is this idea by the Yorshim, where you don't have to return it. And it's not deemed to be metaltalin, there you have a right to take it back. It doesn't become metaltalin, so therefore the creditor has rights to this object. Number three, which is not mentioned in the Gemara, is brought here by the Bali HaTosafot, which is, v'yesh lomar, this is your question, if you give me it back, why does it compel him to pay? Kedei shelo yuchal alovei lichvor. Number one is he cannot deny the outstanding loan, because now we have evidence of the loan through the mashkon. And number two is, v'gami maher lifroa chovo, ulevakesh ma'ot k'mit payesh. He's embarrassed by the fact that every time he needs it, he has to ask for it back. So every time he has to ask for it, that's an embarrassing moment. In order to avoid that embarrassment, he wants to pay back the loan so he doesn't have the mashkon outstanding.
So here are the reasons to take a mashkon, despite the fact that you have to give it back. Gemara says, Taima dahadara mashkenei. Sounds like only if you took the mashkon back into your possession is this true. Halo hadar mashkenei lo. If you did not take it back into your possession, that would not be true. Amar avadar barmatna velav terutzei kamitaritz lo. He says, didn't you already adjust the braita to fit this anyway? Taritzachi. So answer this way. B'chei ma'achar shemakzirin, lama me'mashkenim me'ikara. The question is not why, if you're giving it back, do you take back the mashkon after you've returned it? But rather the question is, why do you take a mashkon to start with if you're going to give it back? The answer is, shalotei shvit mishamto, v'liyaseh mitaltzalin etzel banav. For the reasons that we gave above, that once you take it as a mashkon, originally, not at the origination, but you take it as a mashkon, it becomes yours at that time. Therefore, anything that succeeds that is a loan back to the debtor, and therefore you have protection from shmitat ksafim, you have protection against the children keeping this as mitaltlin, and again, you have the pressure on the individual that he has to keep asking for it. And therefore, you don't have to take it back as a mashkon. As long as you took it once as a mashkon, it becomes yours, and even if you give it back to him and never take it back as a mashkon, all of these things are true because you took it as a mashkon at one point. And that's the point of taking a mashkon, even though you have to return it, is because it does give you all of these benefits. Okay, we're going to stop here. 8 lines down on the top of Kufta Vav Amud Aleph.